Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy. This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to former Buddhist monk and Headspace founder Andy Puddicombe about mindfulness.
Hi, Simon.
I am thrilled to have you on Don't Tell Me the Score. As you know, I was fighting and working hard to get you on over a long period of time. I'm a huge Headspace advocate, and I can say, honestly, you're the first guest I've had on who I've spent, you know, long periods of time in my bedroom with my eyes shut listening to you.
We should probably give that some context for people who aren't familiar with Headspace.
Yeah. You know? I'll leave that to you. Yeah. So that's what you do, though, isn't it?
It is. No, and look, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, no, it's great to have you here. We're obviously talking about mindfulness, meditation, also sport, but before all that, we have to talk about you and your story, because it's a pretty
cool...
We have to. It's a great one.
Come on.
It's a fabulous story. We're not going to, like, pour over it for hours and hours, so let's dive in.
Okay.
There you are, early 20s.
Yep.
Studying sports science.
Yep.
Various tough things in your life.
Yep.
And you decide to go and be a monk, as you do.
Everybody does that at some stage in their life, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I it was, it's interesting. Retrospectively, I'm with you. It sounds quite extreme. It sounds a bit rash, maybe. But at the time, it really didn't feel that way. It's quite hard to, you know, that, you know, people talk about sort of having a cooling in life or something like that, you know, like a feeling that is so strong, you kind of can't ignore it. And I'd never sat down, trust me. I mean, I was studying sports science. I was working as a personal trainer. I was competing in gymnastics. I'd grown up sort of playing rugby and all that stuff. I was going out at night at college, having a good time. At no stage was I drawing up a list of pros and cons of being a Buddhist monk. So this wasn't something that was kind of planned or anything like that. There was just a growing tension, I would say, in my mind. Partly through some stuff, we can talk about it, but some stuff that happened in my kind of late teens, I just had never kind of really been able to make peace with. But also just this growing sense of, I was studying all this stuff, doing all these things that in theory I thought should make me happy, but it wasn't really making me that happy. And I just had a sense that I needed to do something kind of more. And I read about meditation and stuff, and I talked to people about it. But I just didn't feel like I could get what I was looking for from a book or by going to a local meditation class. So I jacked in my degree and got on a plane and went out to the Himalayas, because that's what you do when you want to become a monk.
What was the reaction from your close family and friends?
So
that's an odd conversation, isn't it?
Those that didn't want to have me sectioned. I think everyone had a slightly different kind of take on it. I think my dad was just completely bemused by the whole thing. My mum was actually really, she was actually really proud, but because she was the one that got me into meditation when I was about 10 or 11 years old. So, you know, it'd been around a bit. So she was, my sister was a bit disappointed because, you know, we were pretty close and tight. And my friends at uni just thought I was absolutely bonkers. I mean, it was so left field for where we were at that time. So it was a mixed bag, I'd say. And my girlfriend at the time, I don't think she was terribly impressed when I said, oh, by the way.
She's like, you're just making this up. Can't you just split exactly. up with me normally? Yeah. Wow. It's pretty brave, actually. I mean, to actually, you talk about a calling, but to follow that calling is incredibly brave because as well, it wasn't as even mainstream, if you want to call meditation mindfulness now mainstream, as it is now.
Oh, it wasn't even close. I mean, 25 years ago or whatever it was, you know, that was, it was, it just wasn't even on the radar, I think. And maybe, I don't see it as brave. I really felt like I didn't have a choice. No other thing in life made sense for me at that time. I could have done something else. I could have chosen to ignore it. But it would have been madness. Yeah. I couldn't get my head around doing anything else other than following that feeling. So, yeah.
There you go. Did you intend to stay there? Did you think this is, or were you not planning that far ahead?
Yeah, so you'd think kind of as a Buddhist monk, kind of don't look to the future, be present. But definitely I think I went there thinking I was going to do this for the rest of my life. And I hadn't necessarily really thought that through and the implications. I was young. I was naive. But I did go there thinking like this is a decision. I wasn't thinking, okay, I'm going to go there for a little bit and then come back. I kind of just thought, okay, this is what I need to do. And I just assumed that I would be there for the rest of my life.
And you were there for what, 10 years?
Yeah, so I wish it was as neat and tidy as I went there and I became a monk and 10 years later I left because that would make for a really short story. But it's, you know, I went there and I trained first as a lay person and I found that monastery quite challenging. So I went to Burma, trained in the Burmese tradition for quite a while and trained as a novice monk. And then eventually I took full ordination in the Tibetan tradition. Uh-huh. And then, 10 years later on that journey, I decided to come back to the UK.
And that tradition, the Great Seal, is that right?
Yeah.
No, a little bit.
Look at this.
I've done my research, Andy. Yeah. I want to ask you what sort of that means later. But what did your days look like then? Were you just meditating 8, 9, 10 hours a day?
So it varied. So there were some monasteries I stayed in that were not necessarily retreat monasteries. And in those monasteries, you could do anything from, say, 2 to 8 hours a day, I would say, depending on the monastery. The rest of the time, you're cooking and cleaning and gardening and doing stuff kind of just to help the general running of the monastery. And then there were retreat monasteries or separate retreats where you go for up to a year at a time. And in those, you're doing anything between 14 and, in Burma, even 18 hours a day of meditation.
And 14 to 18 hours a day, 365 days.
Silent.
Is that silent?
No, it's not silent. Some of them are. We do months at a time in silence, definitely. Every day is the same and no Sundays. I think in one Tibetan monastery, it was actually in the West, so there was a bit more kind of understanding. The retreat master said, like, it was Christmas, and he said, okay, you can have 2 hours off after lunch on Christmas Day. He said, nice. You can just sit in the kitchen and have a chat amongst yourselves, and then it's back to your rooms. So 2 hours in a year.
Right, that's amazing. I've read an interesting book. I'm not sure what it's called here, but I think in America it's called Altered Traits, Altered States by Daniel Goleman.
Okay.
And it talks about, it studies yogis who've basically meditated for, you know, in caves for years at a
hardcore
time. And the difference in their brain.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think of prison when you get put in, you know, isolation. Yeah. That's the worst thing that can happen to you. But these guys,
as a yogi, you look for it.
Choose isolation and are the happiest people in the world.
Yeah.
It's counterintuitive.
It's an interesting thing. I think very often, well, I think to be fair, I think when it's a choice, that is a slightly different scenario. But I think, yeah, very often we resist being with ourselves.
Yeah.
In fact, for a lot of us, it's actually really uncomfortable to be with ourselves. And when we're stressed or feeling unhappy, it's particularly difficult to be with ourselves. Mm. So, yeah, part of the training, I would say, is to find ourselves the space and the environment where we can be with our mind, even in those difficult times, and get comfortable with that discomfort. Yeah. And weirdly, although it sounds kind of counterintuitive, that can lead to happiness. So rather than searching for happiness, thinking we're going to find it, we explore our suffering and our struggle. And in exploring that, we discover happiness. Mm. So it's a slightly different way of looking at it.
Sure, sure. So you end of your 10 years.
Yep.
Your mind is sharp as a razor.
Well,
a former personal trainer. Your body has suffered because you weren't allowed to exercise.
That's right.
So another completely logical and understandable decision. What do you do? Well, I mean, what else do? You go and join the Moscow State Circus.
Right? I know it does. It does sound like the start of a really bad joke, but I was. So to give it some context, the monastery had asked me to go and teach in a meditation center in Russia. I actually ended up living there for 4.5 years. And I finished my time as a monk whilst I was living there. So I had 6 months left. And yeah, I'd done no exercise for sort of 10 years, other than a little bit in the Tibetan tradition. And exercise was my life before I got into the monastery. So I was really keen to sort of get back into my body again and do some of that stuff. And a friend of mine was doing a degree at Moscow State Circus. And he said, why don't you just come along, kind of just have a chat and, you know, pay a few dollars and you can get some lessons. And so I started doing that, and I was doing a bit of acrobatics, bit of juggling, and just fooling around, you know. And the guy said, hey, look, you know, you can do a degree in this back in London. And at the time, I was trying to work out, one, what was I going to do with my life? How was I? Because I knew I wanted to do what I'm doing now. I didn't know about sort of the technology and the app and everything, but I knew I wanted to make meditation more accessible. But as a monk, you give everything away. Your clothes, like money, everything. So I didn't have anything. So I was in Moscow thinking, what am I going to do? So this seemed like a really good vehicle to, one, go back to London, two, to get the government as a mature student to actually kind of help me pay for my study, and also kind of get back into my body and just feel kind of like I was part of like the normal world again, you know? So it was amazing. I spent two years, Circus Base in London, out in Shoreditch, and I had the time of my life. It's incredible.
Got the body back in shape?
Well, yeah. I mean, my wife might have wished I stayed there a little bit longer, but I definitely enjoyed the time there.
Sure. And then, so fast forward quickly, here we are. Chance meeting with your co-founder.
Yeah.
Headspace is born.
Yeah. So I met, I went after the circus, I started working in a clinic, seeing people one-to-one. And I was introduced to Rich through a mutual friend. He was a burnt out kind of ad exec. And I was looking for a way to kind of take, and he wanted to learn meditation. I was looking for a way to take meditation outside of the clinic, make it bigger. We were introduced. We got on really well. And he said, we should do the Nike Plus for meditation. And I've got to tell you, like back then, that was so far sort of forward thinking. There were no meditation apps back then. There's a lot now, but there were none. And you know, so much so that I couldn't even really wrap my head around it. The internet had happened whilst I'd been away. I didn't really kind of know what it was. So I persuaded Richie to do events for a few years. And then, 7 years ago, we launched our first app.
And here we are.
Here we are.
40 million users in 190 countries. That's insane.
It's a lot. It is a lot.
Headspace, it's the original and the best. You wouldn't say it, so I'm saying it.
I'll say it's the original.
I'll add on that little best bit. Yeah, I mean, Headspace is, I mean, I've used it. I know lots of people have used it as a way to popularize meditation and mindfulness and stuff like that. It's, I mean, you're doing what you set out to do in a big way.
Yeah, I mean, always the aim was to demystify it, to make it more accessible, to make it non-threatening, to make it feel playful, and to make a positive difference in the world. You know, like I, our vision. It sounds kind of a bit cliche, but as a monk, kind of every day you're committing to reducing suffering in the world. And so it seemed natural to flip that on its head when we started Headspace and say, okay, well, let's try and improve the health and happiness of the world. And it's something that Rich and I kind of care about deeply, and something we've tried to instill in the culture of an ever-expanding team in LA.
Mm. Before we get on to like what actually it all is, how different were you when you came back, or at this point, say when you set up Headspace, how different was the internal working, say, of your mind to when you left?
Yeah, from when I left the monastery.
No, from so when you left sports science, how different was with the two?
Yeah, I don't know if I could even compare the two. And it wasn't that I was necessarily a different person. I think that's one really interesting thing. I think a lot of people think that you have to become a different kind of person. Some people are even scared that they might become a different kind of person. When I go back to like where I grew up and stuff, my mates are still my mates. And we talk amongst each other in the same way that we talked back then. I think what's changed is my perception of the world around me and the experience. So it's not that meditation has changed the things that happen in my life. It's changed my perception of all of those things.
Okay. And what about the stuff that's going on between your ears? Like, is it an oasis of calm, or do you still have those, say, angry or frustrated or scared thoughts passing through your thought stream?
I have two very young children, so I have all of those things going on, you know. I think it's interesting, you know. Before I kind of went off on that journey, I might have thought that meditation was about banishing kind of all of those things, emotions and thoughts, from my mind. And over time, being on that journey, I've started to understand that actually it's more about recognizing that as human beings, it's natural to experience those things. It's just when we give them a lot of attention, they tend to take over, and we waste a lot of energy kind of caught up in that stuff. So I think the difference is that, yes, I still experience those things, but they tend not to bother me so much when they happen, and they tend not to stick around nearly as long as they might have done once upon a time.
Right, let's get into the what's and the whys,
okay,
and all that stuff, because I think that's a really good juncture. Because so I mentioned to you, I did a Headspace devotee, then did an 8-week John Kabat-Zinn mindfulness-based stress reduction course.
Yeah,
very fortunately, with someone who was training to teach in it, and so I meditate a lot, and it's been hugely valuable. In fact, I have people tweet me because I bang on about it on the podcast.
Is that right?
So like, if I hear you talk about it. Anyway. But what I noticed is that rather than thinking that you're going to empty your mind, it's more observing how your mind works. And I think that's quite a common misconception, would you say?
It's a huge misconception. I think it's one of the reasons many people don't even try meditation. They're worried that they won't ever be able to stop the thoughts. Mm. And the way it was explained to me, and we've even kind of made these into animations and things on the app and on the website, is it's a little bit like sitting on the side of a road, and the car's going past there, the thoughts in the mind. And normally how we are in our life, we're out in the road, we're running around, we're chasing after the cars we like the look of, we're trying to stop the cars we don't like the look, and expending a huge amount of energy in trying to kind of control the traffic on the road, the thoughts in our mind. And meditation isn't about clearing the road. It's a road. It was built for traffic. So sometimes there will be traffic on the road. It's more about stepping out of the road and getting comfortable sitting on the side of the road. And as we do that, and as we learn not to be involved in the thinking, for most people, the amount of traffic on the road tends to decrease. Things calm down a little bit, and we no longer kind of chase after the exciting thoughts. We no longer resist the difficult and challenging thoughts, and we find a place, I guess you could call, peace of mind.
Mm. Understanding, I suppose, as well, that those thoughts are not us. Is that true as well?
Yeah, I think most of us live our lives thinking that we are our thoughts. I think the more we meditate, the more we start to see that actually there's some space in stepping back. It's kind of, if we could control our thoughts, we would have done that a long time ago, and we would have peace of mind. And all of a sudden, when you witness your mind from a place of awareness, you see that, wow, actually these thoughts, they just kind of come and go, and if we don't pay them a huge amount of attention, then actually the important thing is they don't just come, they do go as well. There's an impermanent kind of nature to them, a fleeting nature to them. So settling into that, getting comfortable with this idea that actually we can find peace of mind in being less involved in our thoughts is central to mindfulness.
A guy who taught me about mindfulness called Guy Meadows a few years back, he had quite a nice analogy that worked for me, which is it's like a tug of war. And if you've got like the thoughts at one end and you're at the other end, you know, pulling at it, it keeps them there. But letting go, then it the tension dissipates.
It disappears.
Working on your mind, I know... like you experience everything through your mind. You've talked about this. I know I've watched your TED talk a number of times about how, you know, it is everything, isn't it? And we don't sort of clock it.
No.
So it makes total sense to work on one's mind. And I think, you know, you were a PT back in the day, and 20, 25 years ago, working in the gym, going to the gym rather, was not as commonplace as it is now.
Absolutely.
Mindfulness and meditation is catching up not as fast at that. But do you think in another, say, 20 years, it will be as commonplace as gym work?
I think it will. You know, it's really interesting. I grew up in the 70s, and in the late 70s, I remember my mum taking up jogging, and you know, and we as kids we would run with her, not so much because we were trying to keep fit, but because we wanted to make fun of her for running because it was such a strange thing to do back in that. And now as we look at how that's kind of changed over time, there was a CNBC report that came out about 6 months ago in the US that actually showed that mindfulness has already caught up with yoga, and yoga probably had a kind of a good 10-year head start. And I think the difference is that mindfulness, we, you know, there's the opportunity to deliver it kind of through a digital platform. I think that's a big change. And I think the science has kind of started to speed up as well. And we're starting to understand how the brain is kind of influenced by meditation. And then there's kind of just a broader conversation happening really quickly now in society where there's a recognition that mental health is really important and we can't afford to ignore it anymore. So I feel like there's all these different factors coming into play which are helping to speed up how this is being integrated into society.
You mentioned apps and digital and stuff there, and on the one hand it's making us more distracted. You see people staring at their phones, and yet on the other hand there are apps like yours within that same technology that can counter it.
Which for me kind of suggests that it's not the technology that's bad. We can't say technology is good or bad. We can choose to use it in a way that's healthy or a way that's unhealthy. We can choose to use it to promote positive behaviors or negative behaviors. I think it's still new. I think most of us are still working out what it means to have a healthy relationship with our phone and with technology. But I do think, I think Headspace is a great example that we can use this. Like, there's no way that we could have reached 40, 45 million people in any other way had it not been for this. And there's no way that we could have met people where they are had it not been for the phone. So I think it can be used in a very positive way.
You speak about you only need to dedicate 10 minutes a day to make a difference. Is that honestly as little as one needs to do to really reap the benefit?
Yeah, so I've found this fascinating because when I, you know, in full disclosure, when I came out of the monastery, I thought, you know, if it was less than an hour, it's kind of not really any point, you know. And I started to experiment with people kind of in the clinic, and it was trying to find the amount of time that was enough to give a positive outcome. But, you know, it just needed to be kind of like the right balance. And at that time, the only research really was around the relaxation response, which is the flip side of the stress response. And most scientists felt that within 10 minutes, we could experience the relaxation response. So when that happens, our heart rate slows down, our breathing slows down, we start to produce less cortisol, less adrenaline in the body, and we move towards a state of deep relaxation. So I kind of felt that was an interesting kind of number to play with. And as the science has gone on over the last 10 years, we've actually found that it's actually more to do with frequency than it is with duration. So all of the studies that we're doing now, we have 20 published papers, we have 65 in the pipeline, the clinical trials, really robust studies. They're all done with 10 minutes. So yes, we found really considerable benefits using just 10 minutes. Could there be even more benefit to meditating for longer? Probably. And if people have the inclination and the time, then great. But for most people, that 10-minute number, it feels really achievable. And I would far rather people set out with the idea of doing that and achieving it rather than thinking, I don't know if I want to sit for an hour. today and then not following through with it.
Yeah. People still have that resistance to meditation, even at 10 minutes, which is like no time at all. I mean, if you think about the amount of time people spend on social media and whatever else.
I know.
Why is that?
It's amazing, right? That we so often kind of don't do the things that are good for us in life. Same with exercise and so many different things. I think with the mind, there is something kind of extra, which is we often don't want to do it when we're feeling stressed or when we're feeling unhappy, because it means that we have to sit with a stressed person. We have to sit with an unhappy, but you know, and that's the idea that we have at least. But actually when we do sit with those thoughts and with those feelings, and then we create that space again, then all of a sudden we realize it's not the person that's unhappy or that has a busy mind or it's actually just an accumulation of emotion, of thoughts. And in sitting down, we allow those thoughts to play out, and actually afterwards we tend to feel better. So I think that's often what's behind kind of people choosing not to do it. And also just, I don't think we have a culture of meditation being part of our daily routine. So it's really interesting now it's getting into loads of schools and it's becoming part of school curriculums. I think in time, I really think it will become a bit like brushing our teeth.
Oh, just about to say that. Someone used that analogy on the course I was on, and that worked for me. Just make it part of your routine, like brushing your teeth.
Exactly. I would even go so far as to say, if you're struggling to find a way to incorporate mindfulness into day, attach it to something that you already do. So shower and meditation. And then all of a sudden, well, you shower every day. So all you got to do is tack on meditation kind of after that. So it's almost being inserted into the day as part of something you already do. And yeah, in the same way we brush our teeth, we clean our body every day, it's a good idea to clean our mind every day as well.
So let's talk quickly about like what a meditation session, if you like, looks like for people who aren't familiar. So I'll sit down, and as I mentioned, I did this course, so I'll either listen to a body scan but now increasingly I'm just following my breath. So I'll just have my attention down in my belly, follow the breath. And invariably, in split seconds, off I go into thinking about something that's happened or whatever.
For sure.
And I know that my inclination can be, I'm not doing it right. I can still have that pattern, you know?
Yeah, it's a strong pattern.
Yeah, but it's not true, though.
Not true. There is no good or bad meditation. There is simply sort of, we have our attention or we've lost our attention. And over time, to begin with, we lose our attention all the time. And then kind of, over time, we start to be able to kind of focus a little more. But I think it's natural to experience that. There's a few things you can do just to make it easier. So the first thing is not to immediately focus on the breath. So that's a bit like kind of getting on a treadmill and going straight to kind of 10 miles an hour. Like, start off slow. Start off just settling in, just giving yourself even a few minutes if you have the time just to get comfortable, notice the sounds around you, notice how the body's feeling. All of this is sort of bringing the body and mind back together. So generally speaking, the body sat down, but our mind's thinking about something else. We're walking down the street, the mind's thinking about something else. So by doing this, we allow the body and mind to reconnect, so that when we finally do focus on the breath, it's that little, you know, it's a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to begin with, the mind's going to wander a lot, and that's okay. Our only job is not to worry or to think about how much our mind is wandering, whether that's a good thing, a bad thing, whether we're doing a good job or a bad job. Our only job is to realize when it's wandered, and in that moment, to let go of it and to bring our attention back to our object of focus.
And each time we do that, that's a win.
That's a win. Right. All day long. Okay. Yeah. And that is training the mind. It's like a little puppy dog. To begin with, it's kind of just racing around all over. And over time, it learns to sit until eventually the puppy dog is happy just to lie down there and rest in front of us.
Is that what your mind's like? A lying puppy dog?
like a little fluffy puppy dog.
That's a lovely image. That's interesting, though, that is the win. Yet I know from my own experience, that can also be the moment that we chide ourselves most. Being distracted again. But actually, no, that's what it's meant to be.
Yeah, well, and that's where thinking about thinking comes in. So then we're no longer thinking about kind of, did we leave the cooker on at home and what we've got to do tomorrow and all that sort of stuff. Now we're thinking about the meditation and we're thinking about, oh, but my mind just wandered off. So again, for me, we treat those thoughts in exactly the same way. So let's say that happens and suddenly we jump in with, we're thinking, it's like, oh, no, I can't believe... Oh, hold on. That's thinking. You let that go. Come back to the breath. And over time, we start to let go of thinking about thinking as well as just plain old thinking.
Yeah, wow. Okay. So, I like that. Yeah, it's very easy, isn't it? They never stop those pesky thoughts.
I know.
Mindfulness and meditation. Mm. Now, I was thinking about this because I went to the gym a little earlier and I was in the shower afterwards and my mind was thinking about a little... I don't want to say Barney, like small tiff I'm having with my sister. You know, so I'm like having an argument in my head in the shower. But I caught myself. And I think that's the benefit of meditation is like I can catch myself now.
Absolutely.
It's like the change state. But so what is the difference between mindfulness and meditation?
Yeah, it's complicated, isn't it? Because they are used interchangeably so much now. For me, there's a really big difference between the two. So mindfulness, the way I was taught it, the way I understand it, is our ability to be present, undistracted at any time in our life. And that can be, it can be sitting down meditating, but it can also be walking down the street, could be having a shower, could be while we're eating our food. I think most of us have experienced it at some stage in our life, those moments where all the thoughts just seem to disappear. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we're listening to a nice piece of music, watching a sunset, watching our children play or something like that. But normally those moments, they're few and far between. And even when they do happen, they don't last as long as we'd like them to. And it's difficult. If you say to someone, just be more mindful in life. Well, how am I supposed to do that? So meditation is a way, I see, is a way of kind of removing ourselves from the busyness of life and actually training in mindfulness. So it's an environment in which we can cultivate that quality of mindfulness so we can then apply in our everyday life. For me, that's the real value. And even in the monastery, you don't sit for hours on end to become really good at sitting hours on end with your eyes closed. I mean, you know, what's the point in that? It's like, how can you then carry that back to your everyday life? So I actually think, you know, as valuable as the 10 minutes in the day might be, there's another 23 hours and 50 minutes. And it's like, how can we start to be more mindful throughout the rest of the day? That's where the real kind of value is, I think.
That's another misconception as far as I'm concerned, because that book that I mentioned, Altered Traits, Altered States, so people think it's about altered states, so being in this kind of bliss state with no thought, but actually the real benefit is found in the altered traits that come after the meditation, like you said, that 23 hour 50.
This one, I don't know if we've got time for it. This is one, but it's so relevant. I've got to share it. There was a study that was done back, it was a long time ago, where they got two different types of meditators in a lab, and they wired them up with ECG, EEG, and they wanted to see what would happen. They got them and they were meditating, and then someone went into the back of the lab with one of those gongs and kind of gave it a whack. And the person in the altered state, because you can achieve altered states, there was zero recognition that anything had happened at all. But the person who was studying something more akin to mindfulness meditation, there was immediate spike in all of their kind of data, but then it immediately dropped down and continued as though nothing had happened. And for me, that's a really interesting thing, because we don't want to close ourselves off from life. We still want to experience life, the highs and lows of life. We just don't want to be kind of stuck at an elevated point of stress. And ordinarily, we might get that spike and then we'd stay up there for maybe a few hours, a few days, maybe a week or two if we're really stressed. But mindfulness allows us to experience it fully and then to let go of it and continue as though kind of, you know, nothing's happened. And I think that's a really important kind of distinction between the two.
That's like living life to its full.
And absolutely.
So that is where the benefit is.
Exactly, because I feel like we miss so much of life because we are caught up in our own thinking.
You mentioned, I saw in your TED Talk again, like, what is it, half the time we're lost in thought?
Yeah, the study at Harvard that came out probably about 6, 7, 8 years ago now. Yeah, they said 47% of our time is lost in thought, and more than that when we allow mind wandering to take place, we are more likely to experience unhappiness.
Yeah. A ruminating mind is generally an unhappy mind.
Yeah.
Can you meditate on the commute, on the train?
Absolutely.
I do it.
Absolutely.
That's all right.
Yeah, okay. 100%. I think wherever you find the time in your life, and we even have, we even have kind of separate exercises on the app for commuting. And, I think I love the idea that people are finding, they're making smart use of their time, you know, rather than thinking, okay, well, I've got my commute and then I've got to find more time in my day. Yeah. Well, actually, we already have that time in our day where we're sitting there not really doing anything. Yeah. So it's an opportunity.
I stick earplugs in.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm completely over.
People shouting at you. All these friends that think you're just not even responding to them anymore.
I'm over worrying what people on trains think. Before we get onto the sport stuff, quick question for you. One mindful tip that I've learned that's quite good. So sometimes I will set a reminder on, say, my watch, and when it goes off, I'll come into my senses. So I'll shut my eyes or not. Okay, what can I hear?
Yep.
Three things. Then what can I feel? Bottom on the seat, feet on the floor. Yep. What can I taste? What can I smell? And if I do that just for a minute even, a few times a day, I notice that by the end of the day, I'm more level.
Yes.
Have you any other tips of that ilk that you can share?
Yeah, I think any opportunities kind of like that. And I, again, look for natural breaks in the day. So, I used to encourage people to put, even if it's just a blank kind of post-it note on the back of the front door before they walk out in the morning, and you just put in the intention, okay, between here and, you choose the place, I'm just going to be present, aware of the sensation of my feet on the floor. When you get to work, when you're turning on the computer, waiting for it to warm up, use that as an opportunity just to pause, to check in with your physical senses. Maybe it's the sound of the computer kind of charging. Maybe it's the sensation of your body on the seat. I feel like, it could be eating as well.
Yeah.
Most of us will take our lunch break, but we won't really take a lunch break. So we'll be eating a sandwich while scrolling through emails and social, whilst talking to somebody else, whilst listening to music. And there is no way we can do all of those things at once well. Yeah. So better to kind of, before you eat each time, even if it's for 30 seconds, pause, take a deep breath, feel that sensation of the feet on the floor. And it's something really grounding about doing that. And then just check, are you about to dive into this kind of, this world of distraction? Or are you going to take 10 minutes to eat your sandwich, enjoy your sandwich, actually taste the food that you're eating, and then do the other things? And I feel simply by pausing, we start to notice our behavior and we give ourselves the opportunity to change it.
Mindfulness and sport. Not immediately obvious, bedfellows.
Really?
You're right. Let me explain why I said that. So when I mentioned that you were coming in, someone said to me, okay, ask him how, for example, footballers can decompress after the match. And the suggestion to me there is, okay, it's something you do outside.
Yeah, interesting.
I was like, actually, it's more about dealing with those stressful moments during the match. That's kind of, I mean, it's probably both, but that's what I thought. So that's why I suggested perhaps the two aren't immediately obvious together.
And I think it's because most people still think about meditation and mindfulness as, okay, still, relax, calm. And then they're looking at a frantic game of football and thinking, well, how do these two kind of fit together? So look, we've been working with elite athletes for about 8-9 years now. Before we even kind of had an app, and we now work with loads of sports teams, more in the US, but here in the UK now as well. And we work in three main areas, actually four. So the first one is preparation. So how do we help players to be focused and to be motivated throughout their training and before a game? So there is really, really good science that meditation helps us to be more focused.
Okay.
How does
it help the motivation?
During motivation. So imagine like a way that we could, you could think about it is, okay, so you wake up in the morning and you're going to go for a run. Okay, so the thought arises in the mind, I don't know if I really want to go for a run. Okay, now we can buy into that thought and not go for the run, or we can realize, it's just a thought, let it go, and then go for a run. So if you think about from an elite athlete point of view, someone who needs to kind of turn up and train with maximum intensity every time, it's really important they have the ability to see thoughts for what they are, to let them go, and actually continue with the plan that they kind of have in place.
Makes sense.
So that's the preparation. Then there's the performance bit. So I'm going to go back to, the rugby from last weekend.
That's all right.
But you saw it. We all saw it. And there's something really interesting there, isn't there? Within a game itself, how, there is no way at that level that there was a change in skill. Like, there's really not that much kind of change in skill. Something happened mentally. The team kind of, there are always swings, of course, in games, swings of momentum. But that was a really considerable kind of lead, So it's no coincidence that Eddie Jones came out afterwards and said, okay, we're going to bring in a kind of a team psychologist, because this is clearly kind of mental. So how can we help build mental resilience? And at the same time, kind of recognizing that there's a quality of flow in sport. So it's where there's a relaxed focus. Now, if you think about the language of meditation and mindfulness, we are cultivating a relaxed focus. So there's actually, the similarities are kind of more apparent than they may first kind of seem. So we try to give players, athletes, the tools they need to spend more time in that state of flow during a game. And when they're in a state of flow, rather than thinking about their performance, rather than thinking about something that just went wrong kind of in a previous play, they're actually present with what's going on right now. So resiliency and flow within performance. And then there is the recovery aspect. I think recovery has been very much neglected over the years. It's almost like, oh, right, job done, off to the pub. Not in every sport, but in a lot of sports. And we know that as we meditate, we move from a sympathetic to parasympathetic kind of system, state. And again, our breathing starts to slow down. The harmful chemicals in our body, the production of those begin to slow down. And we actually recover kind of faster. We're then more likely to sleep better. Again, we know kind of there's a lot of science around meditation and sleep. We know we're more likely to sleep, and not just sleep for a certain number of hours, but to get restful sleep, which a lot of athletes kind of really struggle with. And then finally, rehabilitation. So we know that meditation helps to reduce the perception of pain, which is a really important kind of part of recovery. So there's preparation, performance, recovery, and then there is a wrapper around all of that, which is how do we help these young players who are under enormous pressure simply live happy lives? Because most of them, and I can tell you, I've been in with countless teams, people who have paid tens and tens of millions of dollars to perform on a weekly basis, and they are really unhappy. So I think there's the performance layer, but there's also this wrapper around it, which is like, how do we help these athletes? It's really easy to look at them and kind of go, yeah, they pay so much money. How could they possibly be unhappy? Money doesn't buy us happiness. Never has done, never will do. And a lot of these players, especially within the sort of culture of social kind of now, like they're really struggling.
Really? That's really interesting. That wouldn't have occurred to me when you were coming in, and I know the work you were doing with the sport, to think of it in terms of from a well-being point of view. Actually, it's obvious though.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Like you said, with the social media and the attention.
And just, I think fans these days kind of feel, so emboldened to abuse even their own teams, their own kind of players and heroes and idols. And you know, you hear some of these players talk about the things that are said about them and their families. Like, for young kids, like, that is a really big ask. It's a big ask even for kind of more mature players in the various leagues. But for young kids especially, I think it's tough.
Yeah, it's a problem, I think, actually.
Yeah.
You mentioned England rugby, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do a little thought experiment.
Okay.
36-24, Scotland are charging back.
Yeah.
Finn Russell is bossing things. Freeze play, you're dropped into the middle, an England huddle.
Yeah.
What magic would you work? It's even how?
I wish it was as simple as that. I'd probably be working a lot more in that environment if it was. I think, look, it's how do you create? It's not what happens in that moment, actually, because at that moment, it's probably almost too late. I think it's how do you create a culture of mindfulness within a team where you're able to let go and learn from losses in the past, where you don't get carried away and you don't become overly kind of confident just because you won a few times, and you're able to turn up and be present as a cohesive team, as a cohesive unit in each and every game. And once you do that, that's what brings the changes. There isn't a magic bullet. I mean, look, I'd love to be able to kind of say to that entire team at the time, oh, okay, look, I know this has happened before, but don't worry, kind of, look, it's not going to happen again this time. Just let go of that thought and you'll regain your momentum again. Because by that stage, the momentum has already kind of swung. So I think, again, it's about mental resiliency. We build it up over time. We build up stamina of mental resiliency. And then in those moments when we are under pressure, we don't crack, we don't buckle, we're able to kind of finish the job off.
I get it's easier, I suppose, I imagine, in that situation, you know, to try and solve the problem by thinking. So thinking their way through
exactly
the problem. But if they'd have, say, for example, learned over a period of time to you know, in those tough moments to be in their feet or to be in their senses, that would have helped.
Yeah, absolutely. So we worked a ton with, I don't know if you follow Sevens Rugby at all.
I like Sevens. Okay. Yeah. Ben Ryan had him on.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So well, look, the Sevens team, obviously at the last Olympics, did an amazing job and kind of medaled. And so we worked a lot with the sports psychologist from the Sevens team. And the captain flew out and we worked with him as well. And it was interesting kind of just chatting through kind of in those moments of high intensity and high pressure, how he was able to quite literally stand there on the pitch, even with all those people, a stadium full of people, and actually get out of his mind, get out of those doubts, to step out of that thinking and to focus his attention on his feet on the pitch so that he could be present enough to actually execute on the kick. And it's tempting to think kind of in that, like, where does mindfulness fit in? Well, it fits in right there. Even if you look back at the likes of Johnny Wilkinson, you know, I mean, there was a man with a ritual, with a routine, and with an ability to step out of his mind, be in the body under high pressure situations, and execute most of the time.
God bless Johnny.
God bless Johnny.
God bless Johnny. What a moment that was. Okay, I'm going to throw a couple of scenarios at you.
Okay.
Because a couple of recent ones. So, for example, let's think Eric Dier walking up for that penalty shootout in the World Cup, okay? Or a player losing their rag, like when Patrice Evra attacked a fan recently, or Kepa refusing to be substituted. So in each of these moments, either an opportunity for the mind to go wild or the mind is going wild.
Yeah.
So if you had, you know, a chance to work with those guys, you know, beforehand or during, or probably more before, because you talk about building the culture,
ideally,
you know.
Yeah.
So what would it look like in the build up to those things?
Yeah. So I think if you look at the qualities of mindfulness sort of more broadly, we start to see a greater sense of calm, a greater sense of clarity, so insight into what the mind is doing, and a greater sense of contentment, so a sense of kind of ease with the mind as it is. So ordinarily in life, something happens, and again, it's just amplified on a sports field. It's not like it's any different from the rest of our lives. Something happens and we tend to react very strongly. It's almost as though it's so habitual, we kind of don't even know what's happened until after it's happened, and then we feel bad about it. So if you think about the idea of stepping back from thoughts and creating space in the mind, in those moments that it happens, there is a tiny bit of space. And in that space, before that thing happens, we have an opportunity. We can choose to engage with it, or we can choose to disengage with it. And so having the ability to, let's say, stepping up to take a penalty kick, a doubt arises. We can engage with it, or we can disengage with it. We can drop it and take the penalty kick. If we're about to attack a fan, I mean, I hope that doesn't happen too often, to be honest. But there again, there is, it sounds, when we're not used to that feeling, it sounds almost impossible. Like, how could that even happen? But with consistent training, we can start to create that space, and that space gets bigger and bigger. It feels as though we have more time. So rather than reacting from a sort of a knee-jerk reaction point of view, instead we respond from a place of calm and clarity.
You talk about disengaging. Now, that's not suppressing, is it?
It's definitely not suppressing.
Two very different
By
things.
Disengaging, I simply mean letting go of.
Yeah, so sort of observing, recognising,
rather
go.
Than buying into and spending a lot of time and effort on it.
And something that strikes me about mindfulness and meditation is you become aware of having that power of choice.
Exactly.
So when those, let's talk about the fan.
Attack
scenario. Yeah. Those flare up, that heat of anger comes up.
Yeah.
You can witness it, and therefore you're obliged almost to have a choice not to go along with it.
Yeah, it's almost like instead of it being, I'm really angry, it's like, oh, look, anger. That's such a different experience. It's a difference between kind of maybe, I don't know, being caught out in a storm and maybe sitting inside a house looking out at the storm through the window.
That's a nice analogy there.
You know, it feels that different.
That's, I really like that analogy. And I think this is a nice time to go a bit deeper.
Right, okay.
Here we go. People in the West think of meditation as like a therapeutic
very often
tool, right?
Yeah.
But actually, at its heart, it's more than that, isn't it? It's about, I mean, people talk about enlightenment, right?
I've heard people talk about enlightenment.
I bet you have. Yeah. I'm fairly sure you have. And it's about sort of understanding reality, essentially. Now, yeah. I'm a fan of non-duality.
Okay.
Now, a lot of people won't even, I think, be aware of what that is, and yeah. will sound absolutely bonkers, right? But yeah. I like, there are a couple of people I like, Eckhart Tolle, Rupert Spira, these sort of guys. And also, like, the tradition you come in, I sort of had a little dig around there as well. And it's understanding the illusion yeah. of a subject-object split. So I'm in here, in my head, yeah. and the world is out there. Whereas the reality, a lot of people would argue, is the personal self we imagine ourselves to be is actually a mirage. What have you got to say about that?
I mean, well, first of all, this is one of the most interesting questions and definitely not something I was necessarily expecting on a sports kind of orientated podcast. Yeah. I love it. It's yeah. great. Look, I think duality actually isn't such a radical idea. Yes, I do sort of, my experience has been that is kind of the case. We tend to live within a dualistic world. So by that, within our mind, there's a start and a finish, a this and a that. And we kind of always kind of have these polar opposites. So there's always a sort of a certain amount of tension kind of in that thinking. And in order to experience the mind in its kind of true essence, we need to transcend that thinking. We need to go beyond intellectual thought to a place of non-duality. And so I think for me, that is awareness, actually. Mm. So it sounds, non-dual could sound kind of very mystical. Actually, it's just being aware. And normally we're caught up in our dualistic mind, our thinking mind of this and that. Mm. Once we learn to let go of that, and we learn to let go of that by resting in awareness, then we experience non-duality. Mm. And I think it's stability of it. You know, so when you do hear people talking about enlightenment and those kind of things, it's not that we're here and enlightenment's kind of over there. It's more about finding stability of awareness or stability of non-duality, where we're no longer caught up in that thinking of this and that. And yes, ultimately, we're looking to come to a point where there is no separation between the observer, the observed, and the process of observing. When those three things become one, then, I mean, we're probably getting into diva territory.
If anyone's stuck with this podcast this long, they deserve it. You know, it's because you mentioned there, you know, there's people think I'm angry, and it's just like, oh no, there's anger.
Yeah.
So that kind of the I that we believe ourselves to be.
Yeah.
Do you go along with the idea that actually it's a mirage, that it's a false sense of self?
It's an illusion. I think there is the ego is entirely necessary. It's quite interesting. You sometimes hear kind of people talking about, right, I'm gonna destroy the ego. Well, who's thinking that other than the ego? Mm. So I think those kind of thoughts are, you know, they're interesting to explore. But yeah, ultimately, we have an ego which is necessary for everyday life. You know, there has to be something that says, okay, I'm going to get up, I'm going to have something to eat, I'm going to go to work. That's really important that we kind of have that function. The important thing is that we don't kind of believe that every thought that we experience is our own, that makes us who we are. If we're able to kind of create that space, then yeah, ultimately we see that there is no fixed permanent I. There is just an ever-changing moment-to-moment experience yeah. of thought, of feeling, internal, external. There is nothing fixed to be found. And I think that does require a little bit of practice to kind of really yeah. experience.
A way I like to think about it, so there's the small I, which is the ego, yeah. which is the I, the me, yeah. the my, all that stuff. Yeah. And then there's that deeper I, which is the awareness that you talk about, that yeah. you rest in.
Yeah.
And do you go along with that deeper I is the same in me as it is in you?
Ultimately, we're all connected. Yeah, I do. It's interesting. We could do a really like simple exercise right now.
Let's do it.
Okay.
I'm well keen.
Okay. So look, what was the last holiday you went on?
Oh, crikey. That's a good question. My missus will kill me. we went abroad.
Okay.
Where did we go? We went, you know, we had a little villa last okay. summer. I can't remember where it was.
Okay. Picture the villa.
Let's call it Menorca.
Okay. Picture the villa in Menorca.
Yeah, I can picture the villa, yeah.
Okay. So right now, where are you visualizing that? Are you visualizing it in the middle of your head, or are you visualizing it out in front of you somewhere? Are you projecting it kind of out into the space in front of you, to the side of you?
I would say it's sort of around my eyes.
Okay.
Got my eyes shut, by the way.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You can open your eyes again. So it's interesting, right? So even on a very kind of basic kind of level, right, we tend to think that our mind is inside of our head. But actually, when we look at kind of how we imagine things, we don't imagine them in our brain. We actually kind of imagine them outside of ourselves. So already, even just at a very kind of early state, we start to see that the mind exists sort of beyond our body. And in fact, even if you get someone to kind of sort of move towards you, we can often feel the person before they've kind of even reached us. So there's clearly kind of the mind clearly operates outside the boundaries of our body. Where it kind of starts and where it stops, I think, is a really interesting thing to explore. But ultimately, yes, my experience has been in meditation, when we let go of that identity completely and wholly, then we find and discover that we are connected with everything and everyone.
Love that. Right. I know this is deep, so that I will try this. I've gone, this is purely, I can't resist. So the modern, the current sort of world view of, say, consciousness, let's yeah. say, is the brain creates it. Okay. The brain creates consciousness. Now, the non-dual view of it is yeah. consciousness is primary. So consciousness has objects. Objects don't have consciousness.
Yeah.
Agree or what?
So I think actually, I mean, I don't know where that comes from. Most neuroscientists that I've spoken to are of the opinion that they don't know yet. Yeah. They don't know yet what is the origin of consciousness. They understand how the brain processes thought, and they understand how thoughts begin their journey in the brain, but they don't understand the origin of consciousness itself. So I do think it's important to separate brain and mind. I think it's fascinating to look at how the brain processes things. And I think we're learning amazing things about how the mind kind of works. But they are fundamentally, mind and consciousness and the physical brain are two very different things.
Okay, right. Enough of the really deep stuff. Okay. I know you were at Arsenal this week.
I was at Arsenal.
You were at Arsenal. And the director of high performance tweeted, he obviously thoroughly enjoyed having you there. So he tweeted, he loved your engaging talk and in particular, the practical demo.
Well, there you go.
So what was the practical demo?
There you go. We were just doing a little exercise.
Oh, you're not allowed to share.
We're doing a little exercise. I mean, I'm delighted he did tweet it. I thought it was all confidential. But we've just come to the end of a 10-week feasibility study with Arsenal. So Arsenal, like us, were of the belief that meditation and mindfulness are at the frontier, the next frontier for sports performance. They reached out and asked if we wanted to be part of this study. I was delighted to be involved. Rich, who's he's a very good friend, but he's also co-founder of Headspace. He's a massive Arsenal fan, so he said yes. And it's been fascinating. We'll release the results in probably next month sometime. And then look to see kind of where that goes, where we've found that in, you know, if we look on the other side of the pond in the US, where we've started working with a few teams in the league. So NBA, for example, we started working with Lakers, Knicks, Bulls. Yeah. And then that eventually led to kind of a collaboration with a partnership with the NBA as a whole and with all of the teams. And my hope is that over time, we'll see the same thing here, kind of where players in the Premiership kind of have access to tools that not only kind of help improve their performance, but also help them to live a healthier and happier life.
This podcast always looks at things in sport and say, for example, take subjects like nutrition or getting more energy and they're really used well in sport. And then, hang on a sec, we're missing a trick because let's use them with, you know, everyday life. Yeah. So the fact that Arsenal are doing this, that sort of comes back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, in 10, 15, 20 years. Companies you'll be everywhere, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's already kind of happening in companies. And look, my favourite thing, although I love that it helps teams and I love that it helps the athletes, but more than that, I love what that does to our sort of society, because so many young kids look up to these players, to these athletes as their idols, as their heroes. They want to live like they're living. They want to do what they're doing. And if they're doing it, then that gives permission for an entire generation to come through and make it part of their everyday life. And hopefully young kids, the next generation, will grow up with this being a normal everyday thing that they do.
Right, Andy, it's been an absolute blooming treat for me. I love it. I'll pick your brains. Yeah. Such a hex that I love. Last two questions, right? So penultimate one. First of all, someone listening, perhaps not a regular meditator, not particularly familiar with mindfulness, are there any sort of words of wisdom or tips or anything like that you can share with them to perhaps allow them or encourage them to be more mindful and all that kind of jazz?
Yeah, so... Look, the heart of mindfulness is not easy to learn at first. So get yourself a meditation practice. Doesn't matter whether it's Headspace or something else. Like find a time in your day, whether it's 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, where you actually pause for long enough to become familiar with the quality of mindfulness. Because until you do that, it's really difficult to then implement it into the rest of the day. And then my advice always, alongside a new meditation practice, choose one thing that you're going to be mindful for the week. So it might be brushing your teeth. So when you're brushing your teeth, be aware of the sound, the smell, the taste, the physical movement as you move the brush. And you're just focusing on that. If you can do that for a week, and then the following week you carry on with brushing your teeth, but you add one more thing. So maybe it's the walk to work, and then the week after you add one more thing, rather than thinking, right, I'm suddenly going to go from 0 to 100 and walking around with an M cape. Like, instead kind of think, how can I slowly build up a really stable practice? And that's what I've seen has kind of worked best. And also that idea of, rather than thinking of this as one more thing to do in the day, this is the one thing in the day when there is nothing to do. View it as a treat, not as a chore. This is the only time in our day when we can really sort of rest, relax, and let go without any responsibility. So as much just reframing it like that, I think can really help.
Chance to just step off the treadmill, basically.
Exactly.
Very last question.
Yeah.
So what is the Great Seal? So I mentioned to you earlier, in your tradition where you were a monk, you talked about the Great Seal. What is that?
So look, the way it was always taught to me was, actually, it was more about kind of being the tradition is the Kagyu tradition. And it's often talked about as the oral tradition as well as the Great Seal. And I think the oral tradition is perhaps the most important thing. It's about kind of this lineage of authenticity, of essence being passed down from teacher to student over many hundreds, if not, you know, many hundreds of years, if not millennia. And for me, I feel like what I'm doing in the world, I'm simply sharing what has been shared for hundreds and hundreds of years. This isn't something I've come up with. This isn't kind of my own design. I feel like the most important thing is, how do we maintain that authenticity and share it in an accessible and secular way?
And just to send you on your way, Andy, I loved it. Your pinned tweet, I'll just read it out. Be present, be patient, be gentle, be kind. Everything else takes care of itself.
That was the advice I got from my teacher when I left the monastery. And yeah, it's been incredibly valuable advice.
Andy Puddicombe, it's been a blooming pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much. And thank you.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening, and if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.